delighted to welcome Stuart Brisley and Jeff Cox, who are going to talk around their collaboration with the UK Museum of Audio. Hand over to Jeff and Stuart.
Hi, thank you. I'm going to stand up. There really isn't a way of introducing this, at least from my perspective, in any really coherent way. So I'm going to quote from a book that I wrote a long time ago, a few years ago, called Beyond Reason, or Duo. Sir suddenly interrupted to say that he was sorry, but he had to go. He had another engagement. He would phone me at later. After 2 weeks, he sent me a copy of a script he'd written after our meeting. The artist was boiling, simmering, broiling, and rendering materials to produce a congealed substance to compare with excrement. It comes slowly into its own as broth, like a common humanity, being of no special quality or type. Class defined by attributes possessed by everyone, just like excrement, and eventually arrives at a state of particles unified by moisture. As the mixture is heated to twice the temperature by which humans will be close to expiring, the water gives up, and just as the spirit leaves the body, separates from its liquid state by streaming into the air. The boiling and rendering process is simple and effective. There isn't an exact equivalence for the complex ingestion, digestion, and excretion system of the body. He remarked on the similarity of the rendered substances to shit. As you know, the United Kingdom Museum of Audio has From my perspective, as one of the three founders, it's perspective in the in my early work or earlier work, which was very much apart from the content, which very few people like to discuss, was concerned with duration and. If I'm known at all, if my work is known at all, it's usually because of the of it being regarded as being connected to notions of endurance, which I've always found rather surprising. So, basically, that early work was, or earlier work was concerned with. Performing is the wrong term, sort of like making actions over a long period of time, say up to 3 weeks, where the effect on the body and the psychology of the individual there is an effect from just merely the passing of long periods of time. And that would also be true of some of the materials that we would use, like food, for example. So there was a consciousness, at that time of thinking about the way things actually changed and decayed and also recognizing that within that process of change were the effects on the self, the person, the individual. That's what my work seemed to be about. I can't say that I was particularly so incredibly conscious of all that at the time. I was much more concerned with the content of the work, I think, and trying to realize something in relation to a subject and and realize something in terms of making a powerful content out of it if I could. That really hasn't changed in a way. So the quote that I've just read actually is about the point I reached in the sort of middle 90s when I was really interested in taking, I've got to remember what the time was, we're talking about a kind of rampant acceptance of capital, etc. And its complex effects on society, not least in the art world, for example. So my sense of wanting to use almost what might be called is like the last commodity in a way, shit, that's produced by everybody. There is a commonality that we all share. It's also a commonality which has become taboo. So it's both common and also hidden. And I wanted to, in a sense, bring that into visibility in a way. And I wanted to use it in relation to different sorts of circumstances. In relation to where I live, and where we live. Mm. And one of the first pieces I made in relation to that was a piece called, I can't remember its title exactly, but the relationship between crown, the crown, and excrement. By the time we get to the sort of early period of this century, you know, a few years after 95, 96, 97, I had actually kind of evolved a sort of strategy concerning a kind of performative process which involved involved excrement, or the simulation of excrement, whereby there could be a public discussion. Very difficult is to have a public discussion with people about shit, because they often have strong reactions against it. It would have been much easier to have discussions with children about shit, because they immediately respond to it. And so there's something happens in life where children have a natural propensity to accept the notion of shit and be amused by it, be interested in it, to actually, and also to recognize when it was bogus. Adults always missed the point when it was bogus and thought it was real. And part of the process of performance was to take the bogus material, simulated as the piece that I read out, the man-made substance external to the body, made into ship-like forms, which were then placed in a performative conditions which would then cause various responses and reactions. At some point along the line, I came to the sort of notion of part of that process was actually producing alter egos. So the person who wrote that piece that I read out to you is a man called R.Y. Serb, who is my alter ego in a way. And Serb is also the director, or one of the directors of the United Kingdom Museum of Ordura, although he hasn't been seen in public. And there are three persons involved in the museum, and any one of which could at any point stand as RY SERB. So SERB is a kind of composite, or is a representative that as yet hasn't sort of entered into public other than in performance. And it, by chance, luck, and through kind of looking around and so forth, I found contact with Jeff Cox and Adrian Ward. Adrian is kind of, how would you describe him, Jeff?
A geek.
A geek, right. And we, as a result of, you know, talking and so forth, we decided to form the UK Museum of Hors d'Oeuvre, and its structure was kind of based on Tate Britain, I think, as a kind of bureaucratic form. And perhaps I'll leave it at that point, Jeff, okay. For you to take over. That's how we started.
There's a description of the museum here on the slide. And you can see that, I don't know if it's big enough to read, but it's a very general statement about the work of the museum in trying to arrest what's inevitable with objects and that they're going to decay. The project of the Museum of Hors d'Oeuvre is to, rather than to arrest this process, to accelerate it. And there are various links through the website, one of which is to this kind of policy statement, really, about the museum's approach to preservation. And there's an illustration here of what's actually happening, because on the server, there's a process running. There's a process that's continually running, which is rearranging bits of information. So any of the holdings of the museum, such as a digital photograph, the bits are gradually rearranged. I'll show you some examples of that a little bit later, actually. Also, the descriptive texts, the letters, are also rearranged. So gradually, over time, the information, it kind of changes on one level, but actually the data is exactly the same. You know, the data is just simply rearranged. It's not disappearing. It's just forming a different arrangement. I mean, I hope that that's enough about the kind of project of the museum. It really is informed by a longer term project. You can see this is a project curated by SERB, in fact, called ordure.org. And it was a kind of playful approach to thinking about how a curatorial process might work in the digital realm. In that, on one side, in one window, is just simply all the information on this website in a dump, just arranged in the kind of generic order that a server arranges data if you just stick it in a folder. On the left-hand side, SERB has been at work and started to curate some of that material and arrange it in particular kinds of ways. This for us, I think, is really, for the museum, is very important in trying to think about technology and indeed processes of history as something which necessarily involves human agency. I mean, I'm showing this slide, it might seem a bit obscure, but it's a slide of an engraving of an early automata. It's the chess playing automata by von Kempelen from the 18th century. And at this time in Europe, there was a lot of speculation about how this machine actually worked. And it was discovered that there was a dwarf actually hiding inside the desk, manipulating the chess pieces with magnets. And this is used at the beginning of the of the essay by Walter Benjamin, Thesis on the Philosophy of History, sometimes called On the Concept of History, to illustrate something of this kind of materialist approach to history. Other people have used this to try and think about a materialist approach to technology, even to something like the use of a computer. It looks a bit like a computer anyway, to think about the kind of processes that are running on the computer and the fact that actually they've been deliberately installed, the machine itself has been produced, of course, but also the materiality of code itself. You know, that something like a graphical user interface, for instance, hides the workings of the computer. We've come to accept this kind of interface as a representation of what's going on. So, stop there. Yeah. So, Stuart, please feel free to jump in at any point. But on the museum's website, there's quite a lot of information, although it probably hasn't really been updated for a couple of years. People have added items, but we haven't really had much time to put to the project. But there are links to various projects that the Museum of Ordura has sponsored, such as this installation, which is of the photograph which I showed you briefly here. This photograph, which is a photograph taken by Rossier Sir, as far as I remember. Here there's a process running such that when people come into the gallery space, pixels move out of position, and when the space is emptied, or when it actually falls silent, the pixels begin to rearrange back into their original order.
Wasn't it based on sound?
It was based on ambient sound.
A certain sound level, the pixels it was almost like a rat running along horizontally along the lines would start to disable the image. Mm-hmm. And then when the sound actually was reduced and went below a certain level, they would then start to reassemble again. So it was almost like a kind of barometer of human presence, as it were, relative to that space. So it was a huge, I mean, probably about 30 feet across, I think, the image.
Yeah. And then this image is also held in the collection of the Museum of Ordura, and this process I described has been running on the server for some time now, and the image looks like this. The description is probably changed a little, just the word addition seems to be changed, there's not much. You know, you don't really know what's going to happen with this process, it's just running. There's on the menu, you can see they're consigned for special attention. Some of the museum's holdings have been placed in a folder on the server where the process is running at a faster speed.
There were periods with the museum where, because we weren't applying any censorship, or at least we thought we wouldn't, at one stage we were invaded by I don't know what, somebody hacked into it and was advertising pornography through every image that the museum held, and we tolerated that for a little bit, I think, you know, thinking, well, we weren't in a position to actually censor it, because, you know, it was against our principles that this should be an open thing. But The use of it became so kind of overpowering in that one dimensional way that eventually we removed it to the Center for Special Attention. And so it became a way of actually dealing with items that were so antagonistic to the idea of the museum itself. At the same time, sort of got slightly off the hook about being censorious about material. I think that's what happened.
Yeah. But I hope it's clear here the analogy to perhaps to some of Stuart's earlier work, in that this approach to software is treating software as a kind of performative process, is something that deals with duration, is something that deals very much with materiality, and that the sort of software process is working on objects, you know, it's continually rearranging material. You can, I mean, there's some further examples here. So in detail, you can see what's happening here. I mean, one could begin to talk about these as aesthetic objects, of course, but, you know, for us, I think, of the museum, the key issue really is how value is attributed here to these particular kinds of objects and how museums deal with the issue of value more generally. And then there's also another project was an audio library, we've called it, or you could call it an audio archive if you like, which was an installation in a gallery where sounds were being recorded in real time and rearranged by another process running on a computer and then played back in real time at the same time as they were recorded. And then at the end of the day, a sample of those files uploaded to the website as a kind of statement on a certain subject of the day.
There was a subject of the day, and the material that was used for which the subject could be selected were the newspapers available at the time in Glasgow, or was it Edinburgh?
Edinburgh. Shall I show the video?
Yeah.
There's a short video.
Position to sue for compensation because it has been deemed that using chamber pots and slopping them out is an abuse of human rights. The prison service is putting aside £44 million to deal with the issue.
Why multiculturalism is the wrong message really establishes this.
With reference to G.M. Lindsay's letter of the 29th of July, can anyone explain to me how our local councillors could justify a pay rise of 350% when there has been no corresponding increase in our region's productivity or wealth?
By nearly 600% in London since the July.
In the same year, farmer Darren Enns, 35, was caught having sex with a family's Rhodesian Ridgeback dog by his pregnant wife, Suzanne.
Scientists yesterday announced a major breakthrough in the fight against breast cancer. The Cambridge team, funded by Cancer Research UK, say that close to identifying the rogue gene that causes up to 1 in 5 cases. Using a new technique which speeds up the research study in
We can understand more about it and develop treatment.
I don't know if that's clear from the documentation what's taking place. It's quite a difficult thing to document because of of course, you're speaking in real time and listening to things which are being thrown back to you from the archive. I mean, in some ways, there's a kind of parallel to the way the computer works, again, I think, in terms of the way that memory operates, in that things are held in random access memory, and some things are held on the hard drive as a more kind of permanent memory. And there's a kind of interplay between those two kind of repositories, if you like. Then, just a couple of slides just to open up some of the issues that we think the work is dealing with, really. I mean, one is kind of emphasizing, I suppose, what I said before about production, about the material aspect of production. This quote by Marx kind of says it all, really. You know, the kind of, I suppose, the crappy shit of exploitation which takes place in the process of production. Or thinking of more this kind of post-Marxist ideas around capitalism operating somewhat like software, like a kind of virus that operates on people, rearranges things for to produce its own kinds of profit. And also this really fantastic little book by Dominique Laporte called History of Shit, which is a history, literally, of shit, and how historically public space and language was cleansed. He uses the example of France, of how the language was purified, was cleansed of its dirty aspects, its kind of common aspects, and the way there's a kind of parallel between what happened with language and what happened with public space. That kind of point in history, of course, where people are no longer going to the toilet in public, but going to the toilet in private spaces. So I guess for the Museum of Ordure, you know, it's interested in this idea of keeping things shitty, you know, keeping things dirty, running software which is dirty, running code which is dirty.
It's about health, isn't it?
Well, a lot of your work deals with health specifically, isn't it? The Museum of Hygiene, for instance.
Yeah. Yes, that's a very interesting photograph, I think. It's the Tate during the war. I think it's Tate, well, it has to be Tate Britain. I guess, I don't know when it would have been, 1941, 42. And one of the proposals by the Museum of Ordure is actually to reproduce this in the Tate. Not by using the same means, but in relation to, you know, the rather kind of po-faced kind of policies about performance and installation and so forth, this seems to have a certain edge to it. And that maybe that's why it hasn't been accepted as a proposition. But I think it should be.
Of course,
because, you know, when you think what's happening in what's just happened in Gaza actually happened over there not that terribly long ago, and this is a sign of it. And maybe we need to be reminded of like these conditions. And I would like to see the Museum of Ordure actually having more of a role in this kind of way, to open up issues rather than to have them hidden. if they are hidden, they are left. A way of, in a sense, of re becoming archaeological in one sense, again, in terms of both the present and the past, recent past.
Your own archive is held at the Tate.
It is. Part of it is. Because I have a big problem with the idea of what an archive is to start off with. And secondly, I've got a problem with after that of what this material is obviously part of, of an archive or could be, and what could be that maybe isn't, and how does that actually operate? And I was rather interested in this morning I've forgotten your name, Dan's approach had some of the same kind of difficulties in relation to what. Actually having any kind of real clarity, because the clarity seems to obscure the purpose in some sense. So it needs to remain open in some way. And so I find it may well be, it's just a thought, that people dealing with their own archives are not necessarily the most appropriate people to do it. And secondly, maybe they should be dead. And therefore, this discussion is over, and other people can cope, or if not, or as needs be, out of necessity, with what an archive of a particular individual group could be. To assume the responsibility for the individual whose archive it is, to assume the responsibility for it, it becomes more complex, I think, and difficult as to what it is. At least, I'm really talking about my own position. I don't want to lay that onto other people, because it's an uncomfortable position to hold. And, especially when there is somewhere an archive with my name to it, or part of an archive, and I can't even sort of exactly be clear about what should be in there, and also because of my own approach as a cannibalistic person in relation to my own history, which sort of tends to eat up things again and regurgitate them in a kind of an ongoing process, which seems, in a sense, to put the archive to one side, or rather, it consumes what could be an archive. So there's a problem there for me. I don't know whether other artists have that problem. Maybe you can be a lot clearer about it than me, that's for sure. But I do think that my own view about the museum of Bordeaux is that we've reached the point where maybe the structure needs re-examining, because it's quite obvious that the material that comes through is very much conditioned by how the thing is set up. And we maybe need to re-examine the terms of it in order to try and make it go a little bit more critical. It was very interesting for a period of time, it seems to me, when we first started it, and how it evolved and what came in. Vast amounts of material came in, rather more than we are showing, well, much more than we are showing. And it had an ongoing life. But then, after a while, you begin to see that it repeats itself. There's a repetition. People are maybe learning from what they've seen on the web, and reproducing it in other forms, as though the museum has a style somehow. And I think this is very problematic for us. And I would like to see the thing developed in such a way where we break this mold and open it up again in a more critical way, in the way that we first started.
Maybe,
I don't know what you think.
Maybe you should enact this image in the museum of rather than wanting, I would really love it if you could enact that in Tate.
Take,
but maybe you should enact that in the museum instead.
Yeah, I
What, you mean online?
I don't know, that's your problem, isn't it? How
you would do that. Yeah. Should we move on to the discussion? Yeah. Peter Dagg, like Jeremy's performance might in the future. You're explaining.
Score for a whole.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
We've got some time for discussion now. Then we're going to have, just to keep your heads up, what's going to happen. We're going to have tea. We can have tea and carry on discussing how you like it. We're going to get into smaller groups and look at some of these questions through looking at objects. And I don't know if some of you remember that I said in the email, I don't know if you would have thought that I said in the email, suggested in the email that you might like to bring something that. Something that you might want to think about in terms of time, but we try to leave as open as possible.
Sorry, it's me again. I just wanted to ask a question about archive and rumour, because I actually checked a story that I told about you, Stuart, to see if I got it sort of right, and you actually said yes. Are you with me?
It was yes, I am about, with you. Yeah. Yes, hi.
Yeah, no, I don't mean, you know, for a long time, but I just meant for this, with this point, I told somebody of a performance I had not seen but I'd heard of. Then I checked it, because in a sense the archive in your case works to some extent on hearsay and rumour. Then I was interested in hearing, not from you but from someone else, about somebody who misrepresented, told of a performance that you said you'd never done. Is this true? Is this rumour something that rings a bell?
Can you say that again?
Somebody in a discussion or in a publication, it might have even been to do with a tape, referred to a performance of yours that you had never performed, had never existed. So it sort of archived a kind of an invention.
Well,
is this a myth? I mean, no, is this something?
It's really quickly, yes, there was, I forget where it was the ICA, and a writer actually reported on being a student at Rotherham Art School or something like that, and Rochdale Art School. And I had apparently come and given this absolutely appalling performance, according to him, and I had been to Rochdale, but I'd never given
that performance. But that interests me.
I mean, that's just these.
No, but this interests me in terms of the archive. When you said maybe one's better off dead, is that because one can't be there to say you're wrong, or because that people make the histories they need for their time? I mean, I'm very fascinated by this.
But I can tell you, give you. Would you like to hear a piece of gossip?
Well, I would, but I don't know.
it's actually slightly shocking, so it might be sort of. It's related to the Museum of Old York. I was at a discussion at the ICA in September, and it was just to do with the subject was radical curation. It's a kind of term I find difficult to accept. And we were all introduced, all five of us. Stuart Holmes one, and I forget who the others were. And sitting in the audience, the podium was, we were sitting raised like that, and with some equipment. People were sitting in rows like that. And sitting there was a man who looked to me, and this is not for the sake of the story, who looked slightly uncomfortable. We were asked to speak, just to introduce ourselves. After we'd done it, he suddenly got up and he walked up in front of me and he disappeared more or less, so I looked over the top. He was shitting on the floor. And this is part of the Museum of Old Doors, kind of part of the Doors or archive. My glass of water was there,
and there were some peanuts there. And he stood up and he put, just sort of rifled around in his pants, and dropped this material into my water glass. And there was a kind of silence. And I said, how terribly shocking. What an awful shock. Etc.
What age of man?
What?
Well, just because I'm interested in what age he was.
He was born in 1957, I think. His name is Alexander Brenner, and he's a Russian performance artist. And he was jailed for doing exactly the same thing in front, I think, of a Malevich painting, probably in Moscow or somewhere. And I forget what his defense was. It had something to do with the cross that was on the painting having a relationship between Christianity and something else.
What did he do with his shit in relation to the Malevich painting?
Pardon?
What did he do with his...
I don't know what he did. I mean, he just shut in front of it, and he was jailed for that. Mm-hmm. And part of me felt sort of honored that, you know, that this had happened in front of me.
Yes.
But then I thought about it and thought, well, it probably was rather effective the first time, but now it's so ineffective. You know, like it's like somebody's trying to do it twice and it doesn't really work. And the outcome of that was that his girlfriend then started throwing peanuts. And I found that rather fascinating because I looked them up on the internet afterwards and found that she's described as a revolutionary artist. So the idea of attacking the speakers with peanuts didn't seem to sort of fit with the kind of description of the person. The ICA at this point had done nothing. So this thing, this object remained there for quite a while until she started throwing peanuts at people and stopped me from hearing what one of the speakers was saying. So at that point I said, since I've been actually stopped from being able to hear what's going on, I'm going to leave. Whereupon I left, and then Barbara is her name, I forget her own name, was escorted out shouting that she wanted to have her apartment. And he then came out and started screaming at me. And that was it. So, as far as a rumor is concerned, that's true, more or less. I mean, that's my interpretation of it, so you have to take it as an interpretation and not the main truth.
Mm. And did anything, this is sort of nitpicking, but I'm interested in what the afterlife of the shit in your glass of water.
The afterlife of the shit was high. This is an interesting question because it was removed from the table by somebody from the ICA and taken out with some ceremony. This was before, you know, my part of participation came to an end. But I think it proves that there's a danger in, kind of asserting something like a museum with a door, possibly. I mean, actually, when I think about how it was, I don't think it was particularly aimed at me, particularly. I don't think it was aimed at all of us. And it was also aimed in a very scattergun sense, probably because I know at least two of us were actually wanting to make arguments against the notion of radical curatorship, but weren't really given the opportunity. So all that really happened was that there was a kind of closure on the possibility of a discussion, which is rather sad.
Was the ICA complicit in this being in the audience? I mean, was it staged?
Pardon?
Was the ICA complicit with those people being in the audience?
No, I don't think they didn't know who they were.
Right.
And I think what it was, I mean, I can remember in the past, for example, at the Tate, there was a big performance by César, and a friend of mine and I decided to disrupt it. It's 1968 February. And We have, and what Cesar produced were these huge piles of expanded polystyrene foam, which were mixed on site and poured onto the floor. And we then got hold of some, to cut a long story short, got hold of these pieces of material and took them to the front entrance. And we're going to take them out. And the Tate were very upset by this and said that we were going to be banned and all the rest of it, but opened a door so that we could take it out. We then stuck it on the gates, all around the gates of the Tate, and then we all met. And then I met a friend of mine who was an art historian and said, would you like to take part in a performance? She was in evening dress because this was a rather exclusive event. We got in by masquerading as people from the BBC, and we walkie-talkied. And so we walked to the main entrance arm in arm and went down the steps of the Tate, and I knew the stuff was flammable. So I gave her a box of matches and said, would you like to set fire to this? And she said yes, so she did. And the flames shot around. These were big pieces, like the length, really like this whole table, that size, stuck like mushrooms all the way around. And we set fire, and the flames shot around the whole lot, went up 30 feet in the air, pink and red, the most beautiful kind of colour you could imagine. We stepped back, the heat was so high, up to the top of the steps, and then out came the director of the Tate, I've forgotten his name at the moment, and nobody could get near it because it was too hot. So there we all were, standing, shocked by the beauty of, maybe, the beauty of this flaming thing. And then in the distance you could hear the bells, because it was at that period of time when police used bells rather than sirens. And you could hear the bells in the distance, and then the sirens from fire brigade. And eventually they all arrived, and then they hosed it down, and then it was time to leave. So we just walked down the steps and left. And nobody apprehended us at all. Nobody. Because it was such a shocking, it was a shock. It was a shock to me, I must say. And it was a shock to everyone. The next day, the police and the fire brigade were in the Tate, and I know this from a famous artist at the time, who was very close to the authorities in the Tate. And apparently the questions were, why didn't you stop them from the police? And the second question from the fire brigade was, why did you have such inflammable material inside the Tate when people that took it outside were doing you a favour? So that's how it was left. The point is that the shock stopped action. That could never happen now. You'd never get anywhere near it. But then, it was a direct action which people were so completely unprepared for, including me, because we had no idea what we were going to do when we got in there.
Has that been written?
It has in South America, because George Gooseberg, do you know George? An Argentinian person who ran something called the Center for Art and Communication, was there. Mm-hmm. And in a taxi going away from that, somebody said, I wonder if there are any British performances. And he said, why haven't you just seen one? And it was reported in South American press. And there is one photograph of, I've forgotten the first name now, but Spencer was the second name, an art historian, standing with a piece of this stuff inside the Tate in Studio International. But there's no description of his work whatsoever.
Was that the art historian who was dressed in evening dress who set fire?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And she never chose to write about it?
No, well, I mean, she was an authority on some early 19th century French artist. She was more interested in history than they were, these was them.
And my point might have been actually rather banal. It was more an observation, but I'll quickly say it anyway, which was that I sort of listening to you, I kind of got thinking about the way that Michelle opened the day in talking about the connection between the cemetery and the museum, okay. And how strongly I sort of felt that what was coming through was not just the taboo against shit, but also the taboo against death and decay, and the way in which that gets sort of displaced onto other material in order to somehow, I don't know, it seems like the theme today has both been about somehow recognising decay, potential loss, which I thought was also going on in Dan's piece about tracing one's own actions and leaving some kind of permanent, and then also in Jem's piece of music. So that's also about kind of recognising it, yet somehow also trying, that recognising decay, but somehow also trying to do something to stave it off in some other way as well, about having something to that will somehow out cheat death in some sort of way. So there is that. But then I was also thinking about the role of shit in archaeological studies. So in a way, it will be our archive, won't it? Like if we were now to gather together a little pool of our feces and put them in a box in and then sunk them in the ground, then an archaeologist could dig that up and they'd be able to tell an enormous amount about our diet, about our lifestyles, etc. So I don't know quite what I'm getting at there, but it occurred to me about the role of shit in the archive as well, an archive of the human species. It's how we, you know, trace ancestors, work out the diets of long forgotten and extinct,
etc. I think the museum of Rituals is probably much more concerned with a kind of metaphorical aspects of the idea of Rituals. What could it be? I mean, could it be BBC's reportage of what has just been going on in Gaza, for example? Is that a form of Rituals? Or is it Al Jazeera's reportage? Is it, you know, everything in that sense is very relative, it seems to me, as to what the nature of Odur is and how it can be. One of the things that I personally was interested in was the idea of the redemption of the base and recognizing the value in the base, as it were. And that has got sort of strong political implications, and that's part of the reason for this for the idea of the Museum of Rituals.
I think it's there on the opening statement, isn't it? About the museum as a statement, also about redemption.
So we haven't got anywhere near that yet. You know, I mean, this could be a long term project in my view, or will be. But that's the. It's to take the idea of shit is very interesting because it's regarded as a taboo, more or less. It's the most common thing. It's what is common between us, like breathing, and also it has the potentiality for generation. It's part of a generative process. It becomes the manure for a future, and in metaphorical terms, this has all kinds of implications. It seems to me at a human level, not just in the most base material terms, and that's what the museum is, in my view, sort of aspiring towards in a way. But how do we? The real discussion between us at the moment is how do we get there? How do we actually open it up in such a way that this becomes more overt? More critical.
And there's a link to Jem and some of the statements that Jem made about the sort of instrumental aspects of the computer, you know, the determining aspects of a computer process. I suppose our interest is in how to kind of recognise the indeterminacy of even something like an algorithm, you know, that actually, you know, or some source code running on a computer, won't really quite run the same every time you run it, because there will be, you know, it'll run differently on a different machine, it will run differently under different temperatures. There are really small differences which give some kind of glimmer of hope, it seems to me, in this kind of world of digital shit. You know, which the sort of hygienic box that we use for so many things these days.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about the internet, really. Just an observation that I was slightly shocked to see the trademark symbol after UKMR. Because for me, that's like, I'm very kind of, you know, like much more kind of into Creative Commons and used to seeing that kind of ethic propounded through the internet. So I'd just like to ask you if that was a display trademark or whether you've really actually trademarked it. And if it had a relationship to the, I saw in the small print that this bears no relationship to the Meteorological Office, and I wondered if you've got into conflict with another body and that caused the trademark.
No, we haven't got into conflict yet.
Right, okay. But the second question was really about opening up, and I guess I'm very familiar with kind of dialogues around the web 2.0 and how you might really, I wondered that what you set up is a self-destructive site, am I right? That it's...
Yes, there's an inbuilt process and that's simulated decay, apart from something called bit rot that apparently occurs anyway.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm not qualified to sort of really go into, right? Could quote you something from it, but apparently there is such a thing. You know, like if you leave everything alone with the computer, it will, you know, there will be bit rot within it. It will naturally decay in the same sense. Yeah. So the whole idea that, you know, there's a kind of certainty about, you know, like preservation is also not true. If it ever was true. One of the most interesting problems is actually the fight against decay. You know, we're all in another level involved with preservation of one sort and another. And this is no less true of the Museum of Art. It also actually has its structures that need to be preserved in order for it to operate. And our virus, so-called at the moment, hasn't yet got at the essential bricks, as it were, of the system. It's got at the images now and again, and it's got at them in such a way that it causes difficulties. Paradoxical, because what becomes corrupt actually also acquires aesthetic beauty at the same time, and so there's another whole dialogue there about how does one deal with it, you know?
Well, I was wondering about if you could think about Wikipedia as being, in a sense, you're arranging the text on a page. It actually makes more, the idea is that Wikipedia kind of makes more sense as it goes along, but that the agents of that change are like all these lots of people moving text around a page in very much the same way as you've made a program which rearranges the bits of an image. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if there was something, if you...
I think there's a parallel with UnWiki, isn't there? The artwork by Wayne Clements,
right,
where he takes all the deletion logs and then you see what's been deleted from Wikipedia.
Yeah, yeah. But I wondered if you would want to get into that kind of opening up your website as a way of inviting people to take part or rearranging.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit... We didn't really explain the participatory aspect, but obviously people are uploading images and can comment on them. But it's not... You know, it's before the kind of rhetoric of Web 2. Yeah.
And trademark?
Sorry, trademark, I think you can decide yourself.
I think Paul had a question, and I think we're going to have to move on to the breakout group because we need to play tea and stuff. But so, Paul,
I thought this is... I was just going to comment that... I was going to comment that I think this is a really interesting point in terms of shit as archive and also... Ordure, rubbish, trash, what we might attribute no value for the future in terms of how we would want our history to be written is in fact precisely where the archaeologist might well turn in order to write
our histories, rather than, of course, the museums that we've prepared for the future.
Thinking, because I know when we went to see the Flashes of Oblivion show, you had some work, Stuart's got these wonderful oil paintings, decaying rubbish. So it almost like turns something on its head. And I remember for me, having just spent some time with the UKMO, this was quite a surprise. Immediately feeling surprised.
Which is where I wanted to go then with a question to you, really, is thinking about those oil paintings. I was thinking about those oil paintings of rubbish dumps, and I was wondering how the museum would deal with the preservation or conservation of material objects rather than digital objects or reproductions. Mm-hmm. Of artworks. So how would the museum deal with conserving, for example, a material object like a painting? And would you, as an artist, gift or entrust the Museum Vaudeur? Would you be interested in entrusting the Museum Vaudeur with the conservation of those particular paintings you've done?
That's a very difficult question. I wouldn't, because the Museum Vaudeur in its present stage is actually only exists in that machine, and the director doesn't exist in any kind of material sense. And since the painting is a material object and would require, you know, live human beings in order to deal with it, I don't see how, unless there was a kind of almost like the political wing of the IRA and the military wing of the IRA. If there was a military wing of the museum, i.e., you know, they were there and alive and had the weapons, then yes, I would. Knowing full well that in the end, conservation, in a theoretical sense, conservation must in the end destroy the authenticity of the object, because over a period of time, it will objects progressively need reaffirmation in one sense or another. And eventually there would be reaffirmations all over an object, so that it ceases to be original in the sense that it would be promulgated as a union object. It would cease to be that object, precisely because of the nature of preservation. That theoretically is one of the end results of preservation, which we're all involved in.